Case number 20-3005, United States of America versus Alvin Gaskins, appellant. Mr. Hornell for the appellant, Ms. Kelly for the appellant.
Good morning, counsel. Mr. Hornell, please proceed when you're ready.
Good morning, your honors. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to present this case to you, and may it please the court. I'd like to start by noting something I didn't include in Mr. Gaskins' brief, which is very illustrative of Mr. Gaskins' relationship, or rather, his total lack of relationship to the conspiracy. On page 18 of the government's brief about the search of the conspiracy stash house, the government wrote, quote, while Island and Miller deliberated over whether Island should enter the building and speculated about why the police might have been there, Miller offered to send, quote, the faggy over, which was a reference to appellant. This paragraph was disingenuous because the government failed to note that Miller's so-called offer was obviously a joke. Turning to the transcript, Miller said, quote, hey, you want me to, laughs, send some unintelligible. You want me to send the faggy? Island, that ain't the unintelligible. Miller, laughs. You, Island, oh God. While the government's mischaracterization of this conversation is suggestive, while the government's mischaracterization of this conversation as suggestive of Mr. Gaskins' involvement should be admonished, the conversation is illustrative. Why would the suggestion of sending Mr. Gaskins to the stash house be so funny to the conspirators? Well, it would be very funny to imagine Mr. Gaskins, the guy that Miller used to pick his kids up from school and take them to sports practice, to suddenly discover a stash house used to cut drugs and count money. I mean, imagine his reaction. I'd like to use my time to highlight a few facts which prove Mr. Gaskins' innocence beyond a reasonable, beyond a preponderance, and even beyond a reasonable doubt. First, in the extensive wiretaps in this case, amounting to over 14,000 phone calls, Frederick Miller and the other co-conspirators spoke explicitly and in code with each other about the conspiracy. When Mr. Gaskins was on the line, they never did this. The government has never proffered an explanation for this, and I've spent hours trying to figure out why this could be. The only reasonable explanation is also the obvious one. The conspirators were hiding the conspiracy from Mr. Gaskins. That's why it's funny to think of sending him to the stash house. They would have no reason to hide this conspiracy from him if he knew about it. Conspiracy requires agreement and specific intent to further the aims of the conspiracy, and neither is possible in the absence of knowledge.
Can I ask a question, Mr. Hornell, which is, why not have an affidavit from Mr. Gaskins? If you have affidavits from others, why not have one from him that would put into the record evidence that from him directly that he was not knowledgeable, didn't lack the specific knowledge of the object of the conspiracy, didn't have the intent?
Well, Your Honor, it was my understanding that the law made it very clear that a hearing would be required to meet, like I said, the minimums of due process. So we certainly could submit that affidavit. It seems quite clear to me that the judge would be simply disregard the affidavit as he disregarded every other affidavit that we submitted. But the reason we didn't submit one is because we assumed that if the motion was denied based on the papers, that we'd have an opportunity to present that information. But we never had that opportunity.
Well, I didn't follow the last part. You, if the motion was denied, you'd have an opportunity to present what information?
We assumed that Mr. Gaskin would have the opportunity to have an evidentiary hearing where he could testify and be under cross-examination. An affidavit is not a replacement for live testimony.
That's definitely true. I mean, live testimony obviously can be desirable in a lot of situations, but I assume that it's not uncommon at least to have an affidavit in addition to live testimony.
Sure, Your Honor.
As affirmative evidence.
Sure, Your Honor. If this were remanded and for some reason we're not permitted a hearing, we would definitely submit that affidavit. In this case, it's hard to imagine that affidavit moving the needle, given, like I said, all the other affidavits, including an affidavit from an officer of the court being disregarded. So I understand the question. I appreciate that. And perhaps it was a mistake for me not to include an affidavit in that motion. But nonetheless, Mr. Gaskins, you know, has the right to testify, and having a, you know, a testimony tested by cross-examination in a live setting would be persuasive, I think, in a way that an affidavit would never capture it.
And Mr. Gaskins did move for limited discovery and an evidentiary hearing before the district court?
Yes, he did.
You mentioned in your brief that you didn't, something like the summary judgment standard doesn't apply, but isn't that exactly what would apply here?
Well, Your Honor, I would love for the court to apply a summary judgment standard. And under a summary judgment standard, the court would have had to take all evidence in favor of the of Mr. Gaskins in this case, because he was the one who was basically summary judgment was found against him. So if the court applied a summary judgment standard, then we would have to have a hearing and with live testimony, because there was the court made credibility determinations based on the affidavits and based on the evidence that was submitted. And frankly, the court took every inference against Mr. Gaskins, which is totally inappropriate in a summary judgment stance. So
I take it you agree that abuse of discretion is the relevant standard here for the district judge's failure to rule on the procedural motion seeking an opportunity to testify and take limited discovery. That would be an abuse of discretion review on our part.
I don't see why it would be in this case. The abuse of discretion standard is there for questions where the court has an opportunity to, or where the trial court has some sort of special knowledge. In this case, the trial court has no special knowledge of in regards to the when it decides everything on the papers, right? When
I'm sorry, I was talking about just to the extent, so the two separate questions. One is the merits, and one is the propriety or not of the district judge having implicitly denied the motion for an evidentiary hearing and or limited discovery. And it's the latter that I was talking about, the district judge's denial of any opportunity to take any discovery and actually put forward evidence. Would that be a legal question, or would that be abuse of discretion, or a combination?
Well, in this case, it seems to me to be a legal question. The judge in a normal civil case, the judge certainly has discretion to limit discovery when appropriate. Let me correct that. In this case, or in any case, because a judge has the discretion to limit discovery as appropriate, et cetera, I would say that should be reviewed for an abuse of discretion, because that is, as you said, something that is generally committed to the discretion of the court. In this case, it is a clearly an abuse of discretion, I believe, when you have a no evidentiary hearing and no discovery, and then the court makes inferences takes the inferences against the non-moving party, and also when the court makes assumptions about evidence that could be clearly contradicted or easily contradicted by documents that were specifically identified. We identified specific documents that we know are in the government's possession that we didn't get to see, that are very obviously relevant, and there's no excuse for the court to deny us access to those.
And those have to do with, those are the documents about the rental of the apartment. What else?
Well, we did a FOIA request for the FBI's files, and we got some interviews with FBI agents. One of them has a paragraph that's entirely blacked out, except for the one sentence that said, I think it said either Mr. Gaskins or the faggy, I can't remember, will take the blame for everything. But the whole rest of that paragraph is blocked out. Based on a FOIA exemption. And we have no idea what's there, but it seems very likely that the rest of that paragraph is relevant to Mr. Gaskin's case.
On the ultimate merits question about whether the district court was correct in denying the request for a certificate, that is also reviewed for abuse of discretion, I thought, based on our court's decisions, but it sounded like you were suggesting that we shouldn't review it for abuse of discretion.
In this case, I don't think it should be, because it was decided in something analogous to a Rule 56 motion for summary judgment, which is generally reviewed de novo. In this case, there was no hearing. You know, none of the factors that would normally counsel for an abuse of discretion review apply here, because it was decided on the papers. And this court is just as capable as the trial court is of reviewing something on the papers. And so a de novo standard is appropriate.
If there were a hearing, if there had been a hearing, a factual hearing, this would be akin to a bench trial. And then we would be reviewing a district judge's determination of facts and resolution of evidentiary conflicts on the combination of clearly erroneous fact finding and or errors of law.
Had there been a bench trial, I think that makes sense. That I haven't looked into that much, because that's just not what happened here. But I think that in the case of when you have a review without a bench trial or without a trial at all, you should use the same standard review that you'd use in any civil case where there was no trial, which is de novo.
Mr. Holnow, let me ask you something. I've been listening to you, and you're ignoring the elephant in the room, which is our precedent from the 1950s, which every circuit who's had this very unusual statute has relied on and cited. And I don't see how you get over the language that ends with the sentence that ends with, whereas here the district judges exercise that discretion. We cannot require him, so on and so forth, except perhaps in a case in which the refusal was completely capricious and without rational basis. That is an enormous bar to clear. And I have not been able to find a case where a plaintiff has been successful in whether, I think a couple have been remanded, but has been successful in meeting this standard. And I find it pretty hard to believe that this is the first case that would clear that bar.
Well, Your Honor, I would say a few things. First, this case doesn't, these cases don't come up very often. They're very rare. So there just hasn't been much opportunity to further develop the law. That particular case had a very, to me, odd statement where it said that the circuit court shouldn't be or shouldn't force a district judge to saltify himself by certifying an opinion contrary to his belief. To me,
it's not just contrary to his belief. He's the 13th juror. And in this case, this trial lasted 3 months. The jury was out 2 weeks. That's how I read the court's language. He's the 13th, or the district judge is the 13th juror. He's heard all this evidence.
Well, in this case, the judge heard this evidence and reached a wrong conclusion from it, which was reversed by this court, and a very clearly wrong opinion from it, at least judging by this court's previous opinion.
Well, you do recognize that there's a difference in this area between not proven and innocent.
Yes, of course, Your Honor. But there's no evidence. So in that, for example, in the order the judge made to deny Mr. Gaskin's motion for acquittal post-trial, the judge made these sweeping pronouncements that had no basis in reality, if I can be frank. And the judge, for example, wrote that, that it is, quote, it is pellucidly clear beyond any doubt that defendant Gaskin's actions as a logical logistical administrator were not legitimate. So when you have a statement that is so sweeping and so, you know, completely, you know, incorrect, if you don't mind me saying so, you know, especially given the complete lack, absence of any evidence whatsoever that DTI, Dream Team Investigators, was used as a front for the drug ring, as was insisted upon again in this opinion. You know, it's very difficult to see that and say that the judges previous opinions should be given deference by this court. You know, this trial was in 2004. It's 2019 when the judge issued his order denying the certificate. And for it doesn't make sense to assume that the judge is remembering things accurately from a trial 15 years previous, you know, as opposed to...
I'll tell you something, Mr. Hornell. You're talking to somebody who was a district judge for 4 years, over 30 years ago. And I had one criminal trial that lasted 3 weeks. The jury was out a long time. I remember everything about that trial.
And I don't mean to give any disrespect, of course, to that. But, you know, in this case, the objective evidence by reading the judge's opinion in 2019 is that he doesn't remember, because he states that DTI was a front for a drug ring and hardly pretended to be otherwise. There was no evidence whatsoever in that trial that DTI was a front for the drug ring. There was evidence that the only evidence that could possibly be determined to be that way was the fact that Mr. Gaskins arranged the flights when Mr. Miller asked him to do so. But that doesn't make
the bigger question that as I took the district judge to be raising is, where's the legitimate business? And there's very, you know, the declarations attempt to fill in that gap. And the brief helpfully points out that investigative firms are not only working for government clients, so there might be other clients. But, you know, the district judge is looking at a tremendous amount of evidence of illegal drug conspiracy activity and really saying, come on, use common sense. If the only game in town is the drug conspiracy, then, you know, that's evidence that DTI is a front. At least that's how I understood his reasoning.
Well, there's evidence certainly that Miller and the other conspirators got almost all of their money from the drug conspiracy. I think that's true. The question is whether or not Miller used DTI as a drug front. And there's no evidence of that. There's only evidence that DTI that Miller was involved in the drug conspiracy and that Miller had this business, DTI, you know, an investigative firm that he was building up on the side. And the question is, you know, is there any evidence that Mr. Gaskins, who worked for DTI, did the taxes, et cetera, knew about this other business?
And did Gaskins also work for the government at the time? Was he, did I pick up that he had some government ID or he worked for the Veterans Administration? No.
That Mr. Gaskins did?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't believe so. I think Mr. Gaskins' only income at the time, at least that I know of, was the modest salary he was drawing from DTI. We should also talk about DTI, right? So I would love to have more evidence of DTI's legitimacy, but I was denied access to any of those documents. There are bank statements I haven't been able to see. There was, you know, there were these DTI related documents that were seized from Miller's apartment and Miller's aunt's apartment that we should assume those have nothing to do with the drug conspiracy, because if they had anything to do with the drug conspiracy, they would have gone in with all the rest of the evidence.
So can I ask you a question about the relationship between the previous opinion that our court handed down in this case and then the certificate proceeding that we're dealing with now? Is the way that you understand the interrelationship that just by virtue of the opinion we rendered last time, was that in and of itself, including the descriptions in it about the evidence, was that in and of itself something that would have dictated the issuance of the certificate, or did something more have to happen?
Thank you. That's a great question. I, you know, as a general rule, a opinion overturning a conviction for lack of evidence is not enough for a certificate of innocence, right? There has to be more to it. I think this court's opinion does provide enough of a corrective, enough of a statement to say that it does mandate it, right? You can't look at a dragnet of the size that was put around this drug conspiracy. It was very serious, very, you know, deadly drug conspiracy. It failed to turn up any evidence whatsoever against Mr. Gaskins, and then go on to say, well, it's probably true that he was involved anyway. There's nothing but speculation that would cause that. There's no evidence that would actually believe that. The court's opinion didn't write, there isn't sufficient evidence of Mr. Gaskins' involvement. It said there is no evidence of Mr. Gaskins' involvement.
What about the putting that in the context of the procedural posture, which is the sufficiency of the evidence to prove something beyond a reasonable doubt? And, you know, the notion that it's a sort of a term of art, is there any evidence sufficient that a reasonable juror could have found beyond a reasonable doubt? And you say that once, and then every other time in the opinion, you say no evidence, no evidence, no evidence, meaning no evidence that would meet that bar, whereas it's a completely different bar in the context of the civil determination of innocence.
Sure. I think that, you know, the way I read this court's previous opinion, really, it, to me, used much stronger language than was necessary. I don't believe that we should narrow the opinion or narrow the reading of these cases where we say there's insufficient evidence, but then try to take every word completely literally, an opinion that says that, the 1950s opinion, for example, that the Honorable Judge Henderson had referenced earlier. The language in this court's previous opinion was far, far, far stronger than would have been necessary to just say, well, there wasn't sufficient evidence. This was too weak to kind of to make a finding beyond a reasonable doubt. You know, that's not what's there in that opinion. That opinion has, a paragraph which I quoted in my brief, which, you know, says there is no evidence of that puts him in any conversations about drugs, drug money. There's none of the cooperating witnesses had anything.
Let's suppose that we just assume that we disagree with you on that. I know you resist that, but just assume for argument's purposes that you disagree with that. We disagree with you on that, and we read it more in the way that Judge Pillard was suggesting. And I don't mean to suggest that Judge Pillard necessarily reads it that way. I'm just saying, let's just assume that it's read in that way and through the lens of the beyond a reasonable doubt standard. And so that's what our prior opinion stood for. Then the opinion itself doesn't do the work to give you an entitlement to a certificate at that point, right? Because the burden is on you to prove something.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that the burden is on the person seeking the certificate to prove to a preponderance their innocence. I think it's very important to keep in mind, the possibility of proving this, right? There's no way that anybody could ever disprove, right, their involvement in a conspiracy, right? Because there is nobody there during every conversation that person had. The only way that Mr. Gaskins could prove absolutely that he was not involved is to had walked around with a camera 24/7 for those years and years and show all the video and say, hey, look, it was never there. So we do have to take into account, you know, the possibility. And what we have is we have this constellation of evidence. And so when you look at that constellation of evidence, regardless of what this court said in its previous opinion, when you look at that constellation of evidence, it proves, I think, beyond a reasonable doubt or even beyond a shadow of a doubt that he wasn't involved. You just don't have that kind of investigation and don't turn up any evidence. It doesn't make any sense. You don't have a person who's an administrator for a drug conspiracy, as the government puts him in here, living in a modest apartment with his mother for years. And you don't have, you know, a long set of cooperating witnesses who had every reason to throw Mr. Gaskins under the bus, who were facing, you know, life in prison. None of them had said he had any involvement in that. And these aren't honorable people, right? these are drug conspirators who are, you know, involved in a violent conspiracy. Okay. So we have to ask, why didn't they say he was involved? And I think the only reasonable thing to conclude from that is that he wasn't.
Okay, let me make sure my colleagues don't have any additional questions for you at this time, and we'll give you a little time for rebuttal.
I don't.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hornell. We'll hear from the government now.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Catherine Kelly on behalf of the United States. Your Honors, in this case, the district court properly denied and did not abuse its discretion in refusing to grant Mr. Gaskins a certificate of innocence because he failed to establish that he did not commit any of the acts charged. It's important to remember that the burden of proof at this juncture is on appellant to show his actual innocence, which is very different, as the court realizes, from this court saying that there was insufficient evidence of his guilt in the conspiracy beyond a reasonable doubt. Knowing that the burden is on Mr. Gaskins, he chose not to submit an affidavit explaining his knowledge and his intent in this situation, despite the fact that there's no procedure in the statute or, frankly, no legal authority that requires either discovery or an evidentiary hearing in a certificate of innocence proceeding. The government is unaware of any such requirements. And the few cases that have decided on certificates of innocence indicate that they can be decided on the papers, on the trial record, documentary evidence, affidavits, and so forth that are submitted by the parties.
Did the government respond to the motion for an evidentiary hearing? I didn't see it in the record, and I just want to make sure I'm understanding the record correctly.
But the government did not, Your Honor. It wasn't asked to by the courts, and my recollection is that the court had decided without asking the government to respond. So Your Honor did not miss anything in the record.
So the government had no objection, it appeared, to the request for limited discovery and a hearing. And typically when a party has the burden of proof, they also have some opportunity to gather information and or, you know, have a process for putting that before the court. But it's your reading that this is an exceptional situation in which there's no such opportunity?
My point was, Your Honor, is I have not seen any case law that indicates that discovery is required or that an evidentiary hearing is required. And that, in fact, appellant acknowledged in his district court filings at JA-87 that the unjust conviction statute does not direct district courts to follow particular procedures in determining whether a petitioner is entitled to a certificate of innocence. It's a little unusual in the aftermath of a criminal trial, given that Mr. Gaskins received all the required documentation. There's been no claim of withheld information in the criminal proceedings here, that he would need additional discovery. And frankly, a number of the documents that he cited, particularly the lease agreement and the rental agreement for the stash apartment, those were publicly available. Those were trial exhibits. The flight information document was also a trial exhibit. To the extent that he attached to his motion for discovery an FBI interview with Mr. Miller, it's clear, even with the redacted information, that it is, in fact, Mr. Miller who's been spoken to. We have a situation here where, although appellant did not bother to submit his own affidavit, he did get Mr. Miller to write an affidavit for him and submit it. He certainly was able then to ask Mr. Miller, what else did you tell the FBI?
So it seems like your position comes down to that in order to have an opportunity, I mean, one major difference, obviously, between the criminal trial and this civil proceeding is that Mr. Gaskins would have a reason not to testify in the criminal trial, given his Fifth Amendment right, whereas here, once he's been acquitted, he might want to come forward and testify. So it seems like your position is that because he didn't submit his own declaration, that cuts off his opportunity to be heard in person in a hearing. Is that your position, that if he had submitted a declaration, that the district court might have exercised discretion to go forward and hear from him or not, but that that evidence would have been in place, but that given that he didn't do that, he forfeited any, even though he asked for the ability to testify and to get more information, that he's forfeited that by not putting a declaration in the record?
I think so, given the case law that we have, where there it's of course appellant's burden to show that he's actually innocent. And in an inchoate crime like conspiracy, that's your best evidence. What is in Mr. Gaskin's mind when you are seeking to get money for an unjust conviction and the burden is on you, and knowing that the case law does not indicate any sort of requirement for an evidentiary hearing or discovery, it really is incumbent on you, if you're going to support your burden by a preponderance of the evidence, to put forth what was in your own mind.
Right. Well, the case law in our circuit is very, very sparse. Indeed, the case law nationally is pretty sparse. But you do cite the Pulungan versus United States case out of the Seventh Circuit.
That's right, Your Honor.
Which does seem to support remanding for an evidentiary hearing in this case, because there was it was the inverse. There was a certificate grant, but the district court had not yet heard from the former prisoner on his state of mind. And there too, criminal intent was key. And that was a case of I think it was exporting defense articles without a license. So why shouldn't we be just as willing to vacate a certificate denial for want of the in-person testimony from the very person whose state of mind is critical?
Well, because appellant has already had that opportunity. There was absolutely nothing stopping him from putting his state of mind directly into the record with his own affidavit. Of course, indulgence, I have the Pulungan decision here. It was a very narrow question about I believe the question, if I'm understanding it correctly, in Pulungan was about whether or not a particular item, which was a rifle scope, was considered a defense article under the statute. And there was some question about its classification and whether or not would be evidence allowed from the agency about its classification, and whether or not it met regulatory criteria. And then if that happened, if there was such evidence from the agency and whether or not it met regulatory requirement, then as a practical matter, defendant could show his actual innocence only by testifying about his knowledge. That's different than what we have here, where really the whole question before the court to establish his actual innocence is what was in Mr. Gaskin's mind. He chose not to tell the court that, and there's really no reason to give him a second bite at the apple.
I don't see how that distinguishes Pulungan, which also dealt with what was in the individual's mind, whether he was someone who had reason to believe that the scope was a controlled article, or whether it was plausible, as I think he claimed, that he thought there was some kind of, you know, embargo to Indonesia or something. But the question is the same, in the sense of we need to have the district court be able to probe and assess the credibility of the person who's claiming lack of knowledge. And, you know, when you actually have that person on the stand under cross-examination And in Mr. Gaskin's case saying, yeah, I worked for this Miller for a while. And, you know, counsel could say, well, you know, did it surprise you that there did not seem to be very many clients coming and asking for investigative services or, you know, and I mean, isn't that just the kind of thing that were Mr. Gaskin's able to testify credibly, the court would potentially be swayed by, and were he not, that one would have more confidence in the denial?
Your Honor, I would just say first that I'm not saying that a court can never hold an evidentiary hearing, certainly, but in this case, kind of similar to the Grubbs case in the Sixth Circuit, the defendant chose not to add that to the record, and therefore the court properly relied here a lot on the trial evidence to make its decision. Appellant chose to put in other affidavits and not his own, and I would also note that twice in his pleadings, Mr. Gaskin said that he believed he had met the burden to obtain the certificate of innocence on the pleadings alone. And it was only if he thought that the court was going to rule against him that he argued that he should get a hearing and the right to discovery. And again, it's simply given this case, given that the real knowledge is in Mr. Gaskin's head, there was no reason for him not to file his own affidavit, particularly given the state of the law and the fact that there aren't particular procedural requirements written into the law.
Let me ask you, Ms. Kelly, nobody's discussed yet the fact that Judge Lamberth also said there was a failure on this prong about neglect or misconduct. And he ended by saying, although he may have been a limited participant, he knew or should have known. Now, the should have known is what I'm interested in asking you about some of the trial evidence. We said in our opinion, reversing his conviction, although there was substantial evidence of the wealth amassed by other conspirators, there was no such evidence regarding Gaskin's. To the contrary, he lived in a modest apartment with his mother. Now, if we take Miller's affidavit in this iteration of this case, that Gaskin's, notwithstanding he was a gopher, insisted that Miller prove that this investigative agency was on the up and up. Let's take that.
So we may have just lost Judge Henderson's audio, and I make sure she was in the middle of a question.
Paints a picture of Gaskin's as
all right. I'm having.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. We can hear you now, Judge Henderson. I think we lost you there for just a minute.
Okay. Well, did you hear me talk about Miller's affidavit?
It was going in and out, Your Honor.
Just started to talk about it, but then didn't hear the.
All right. Well, Miller. All right. Miller painted the picture, and I don't know what's wrong with my internet again, but painted a picture of a gopher being very punctilious to the extent of insisting that he prove that the business was on the up and up. So my question, I guess, from the trial evidence is this substantial evidence of the wealth amassed by the other conspirators. Is it reasonable for someone like Gaskin's, who made a big deal out of making sure this was a legitimate business, to think that that investigative agency would support the lifestyle of his co-conspirators?
Your Honor, I think the fact that Mr. Miller said that Mr. Gaskin's essentially required him to prove that DTI was a legitimate company really informs the fact that shows that Mr. Gaskin's was indeed suspicious of DTI. And if he's going to the length before he takes a job to ask the person who offers him a job to show that it's a legitimate company, that tells you boatloads that he's suspicious.
Well, what about the substantial evidence of the lifestyle of the co-conspirators? Have you looked at the trial evidence in that regard? I mean, what was put in?
I recall there were, there was trial evidence about how much money was being obtained, you know, how much, particularly the heroin was in the, you know, five figure numbers, as far as how much it was worth when it was bagged and so forth. I believe there was one, cooperator who was talking about having a lavish lifestyle. But I don't think that it really answers the questions to say Mr. Gaskins got $600 a week for his input into the conspiracy. It's not clear that the fact that he made less than other conspirators, for instance, means that he was not a participant, a knowledgeable and active participant in the conspiracy.
Well, what I guess what I'm really asking is this, is it reasonable if you assume that Mr. Gaskins did all this investigation of the agency first, and in the face of substantial wealth of all these people he was dealing with, he still thought, well, I'm still suspicious, but I'm not going to do anything about it. That's the should have known part of the prong.
Correct, Your Honor. And I don't think it's reasonable for him to say that I'm seeing this wealth and it doesn't raise my suspicions, particularly when you look at it along with the other evidence. He had a drug sale of his own to Mr. Briggs, who was a conspirator in this case. So this isn't somebody who was a babe in the woods who knew nothing about the drug trade. The nature of the flights that he was booking, they were last minute, they're short turnaround flights for Mr. Brown, who ultimately was a money mule, for lack of a better word, for the conspiracy. He's subscribing to these cell phones, which are now claimed to be for DTI's business and for Mr. Miller's business. But it's highly unusual for an employer to say, you know, you're going to, you know, perhaps you order the business phones, but you don't do it in your own name with your own social security number and then just hand them off to the other folks.
So does it matter? I mean, this is a curious position to be in, but let's say you were the district judge. And I just wonder how much the formalities matter, you know, that the flights that Gaskin booked were by, as you say, a money mule, but the drug money there was not from the drug of which Mr. Gaskin was convicted. So there's a, you know, he was convicted of a heroin conspiracy, even though the broader conspiracy, the conspiracy charges generally were a number of different drugs. But if that, you know, if Brown, and I don't remember whether it was PCP or, you know, the money coming out of that locale wasn't heroin money, does that matter? You know, how formal, like there, the evidence that comes the closest to saying Mr. Gaskin might've been putting his head in the sand, those close, you know, implications of, come on, guy, you should be backing out away from these people, are not the thing that he was charged with. Does that prevent him from getting a certificate of innocence? Or
I think you can look at all the evidence in deciding whether or not to grant the certificate of innocence. And one of the prongs under the statute is that he has to show that he did not commit any of the acts charged. And that he didn't, by misconduct and neglect, cause or bring about his own prosecution. So here he was charged with conspiracy to distribute heroin, PCP, crack, and powder cocaine. And it was his neglect, at the very least, that caused his own prosecution. He hid his head in the sand at the very most. And that's assuming he didn't know already what was going on. He had his lease name on the lease for the stash apartment, on the rental application, there were utilities in his name for that apartment and so forth. And the court will recall too, that there was a lot of evidence at trial that although DTI was holding itself out as a defense investigation agency, Mr. Kramer from the Federal Public Defender Service testified that 90% of the folks who are criminal defendants in DC are CJA eligible, and that there were no funds given to DTI or any of the conspirators.
So this line of argument on the neglect prong, that wouldn't succeed in the way that the Seventh Circuit looks at the neglect prong, right? It's contingent on looking at the neglect prong in a different way.
That's correct, Your Honor. And we would respectfully say that the Seventh Circuit reads that too narrowly, that the Graham Court and the Fourth Circuit got it right, that you can look at the evidence at trial and so forth. It's just not a matter of, you have to take a material step to, for instance, I think that case was making a false confession in order to create your own situation.
Right. So we have different courts of appeals that look at this prong differently, at least as it stands right now, one of which would be in your favor and one of which would not on this prong. And can I just go back to the other prong for one last question? And there's one line in the district court's opinion that was interesting to me, and this is on page 105, JA 105, at the end of the first full paragraph. And this is after having gone through some of the indications about whether Gaskins would have known that he was involved in an enterprise that had an illegitimate object. And the district court caps off that paragraph by saying, the burden of proof belonging to Gaskins in this action, this argument does not persuade without more affirmative evidence. And on the without more affirmative evidence part, I suppose one potential response to that is, well, there could have been more affirmative evidence if the motion for an evidentiary hearing would have been granted or some discovery would have been allowed or some combination thereof. And then you've got your point, which you made in your brief and you've reiterated this morning, to the effect that, well, there could have been more affirmative evidence had an affidavit been submitted by Mr. Gaskins. And I'm just wondering what we do with that line, given that the district court itself seems to contemplate the possibility of more affirmative evidence making a difference.
I would just read that, Your Honor, as saying that Mr. Gaskins did not meet his burden of proof, even after saying twice in his pleadings that he thought that he had presented enough evidence to in his pleadings alone to get a certificate of innocence.
But that's that's an alternative argument. I find that a little harsh in the sense that, you know, he looks at this opinion, which does involve very far reaching investigation, many, many cooperators. And if the prosecution really were dotting its I's and crossing its T's, it would have had one of those cooperators expound on Mr. Gaskins' role. That didn't happen, right? And I, you know, as I was saying to Mr. Hornall, you know, the no evidence has to be taken in the procedural posture. But nonetheless, there's, you know, the Court of Appeals does say no evidence, no evidence. So first line of argument on their part, the acquittal for insufficient evidence alone is enough. Second line of defense, which the government never opposed, is give us an opportunity to collect and put in evidence. What's wrong with that?
Just simply that the burden was on him, and based on the existing case law, there is no clear right to an evidentiary hearing or to discovery. And in addition to that, it's simply a matter of when you don't choose to put in evidence, then you're stuck. If you make that decision, then that's that. He had the best evidence in his own mind.
But is that the choice he made when he asked for discovery? That's not the choice he made.
I just don't see what is going to happen in discovery that is going to show his state of mind. I believe that there's just no way. And I think Mr. Hornall said this in his own argument a while ago, there's no way to disprove his involvement in the conspiracy. So I frankly don't see what's going to happen if you get a document dumped from the government to show that Mr. Gaskins did not act as a logistical support who was arranging things that were not him touching the drugs for the conspiracy. And you look at the items he attached to his motion for discovery, it's stuff that he had at his fingertips already. They were exhibits from trial. It's information that he wants more information about what Mr. Miller said to the government. Ask Mr. Miller, you got an affidavit from him. You certainly know how to find out what's in Mr. Miller's mind.
Ms. Kelly, is it not, it seems like it's possible it's an abuse of discretion for the district judge to not even mention, acknowledge, or rule on the motion for limited discovery and an evidentiary hearing?
I think it's just implicit in the court's decision that it was denied. I don't know that the court needs to mention that. It's quite clear that the court denied it. I'd note one other thing too. Mr. Hornall's mentioned this as being akin to a Rule 56 proceeding, and there's simply no certificate of innocence case law that indicates that getting a certificate of innocence is a Rule 56 proceeding. There's one court that actually said I believe it was the Abu Shawish decision in the Seventh Circuit, said it's more like moving to get your seized property returned to you under criminal Rule 41G. But even if you're going to have a Rule 56 proceeding, this court said in the Pollack decision that if you're claiming to need discovery for summary judgment proceedings, you have to put in an affidavit explaining why discovery is needed. So once again, you have a situation where appellant would have to put in his own affidavit saying, this is why I need discovery in this case. Because frankly, in this case, he's trying to say, I don't know what was in my own head, which is of course ridiculous.
Let me make sure my colleagues don't have additional questions for you, Ms. Kelly.
I do have one out of Rigsby, and that is this very high bar that our court has set with the use of the word stultify. And if you look at that paragraph, the court, it doesn't limit it to the presiding judge, but it is the presiding judge in that case. And there are going to be times, and I think some of those other cases, at least one of them had a district judge reviewing a certificate of innocence who had not been the trial judge. But here, Judge Lamberth had been the trial judge. And so our court set at least an extremely high bar where the judge had been the trial judge. Do you see any lessening of that if he hadn't been? In other words, the use of the word stultify, you can see the panel saying this trial judge sat through 3 months, jury out 2 weeks. He listened to all the evidence, and we're going to say, notwithstanding we're reversing it, that it's been reversed, we're going to say that he's got to certify that the defendant is in fact innocent and had nothing to do with his prosecution, except, and the bar is that we're going to say only if perhaps the trial judge was completely capricious and without rational basis in denying it. I don't know that I've ever read a standard of review that's that high.
No, it's extremely high. In fact, if I recall correctly, the Rigsby court had even questioned for a moment whether or not there could be appellate review of the denial of the certificate of innocence, and then came to the conclusion that it would review for abuse of discretion. As Your Honor had said earlier, the trial judge here was in fact sitting as a 13th juror when he was looking at the certificate of innocence evidence before him. And it was a very lengthy case. And I would also note too, that this is not a case where there's really a concern that the district court has forgotten the facts. I believe Mr. Miller within the last 6 to 9 months was resentenced for a third time in this case. So this is not a case that went away in 2006. It's still living in some manner in the district court today. Thank you, Your Honor, for all the reasons we've stated, and given particularly the evidence at trial, we respectfully request that you affirm the decision of the district court. Thank you,
Ms. Kelly. Mr. Hornell, we'll give you 2 minutes for your rebuttal.
Thank you. There's a lot to get through. I'll get as fast as I can. Let's first turn to the case Abu Shawish versus United States in the Seventh Circuit. The district court in that case denied a petition for certificate of innocence without giving the petitioner an opportunity for the hearing, and the circuit reversed and held that the court was required to conduct the hearing on the evidence. And I note that in my reply brief. It's also, as I mentioned in the brief several times, a minimum of due process, the right to a hearing when there's going to be a deprivation of property. And in this case, there's a very severe deprivation of property. There's a lot of money.
We do summary judgment back and forth all the time without a live hearing.
Sure, of course. But in that case, you take all the evidence in the favor of the non-moving party, which the court did not do in this case. So if we're using that standard, then you know, you still have to remand. I'd like to talk a little bit about the standard of completely capricious and without rational basis. I don't believe that is the standard of review on these cases. But even if it is, Mr. Gaskins meets that. It is completely capricious to refuse access to evidence when evidence is available and when has been shown to be available. For the government to say that Mr. Gaskins can just ask Mr. Miller what he said in this interview and then put that into an affidavit, that's not credible evidence. That's not going to be accepted by the court. It was completely capricious for the district court to say the DTI is a front. There is no evidence the DTI was a front. None. The only evidence that was mentioned, which is that they didn't apply for CJA reimbursement, was already called by this court hardly substantial. And for it to pin an entire theory of case on something that the appeals court has already said is hardly substantial is absolutely capricious. The argument about the substantial wealth of others in the conspiracy, I'd like to point out that my understanding is that is for the others who are not Miller in the conspiracy. I believe Miller was sort of like a middling figure in the conspiracy, as opposed to the others who did have an awful lot of money. And that's something that needs to be developed at trial with evidence. If we're going to talk about these things, you know, trying to shoehorn it into a short argument at the Court of Appeals when you didn't even get a chance to do the trial is not a fair procedure and not reasonable and not likely to result in accurate fact finding. Going back to the utility and the rental agreement, one of the documents we got through FOIA that we would not have gotten otherwise was this FBI fingerprint report. The fingerprints of Mr. Gaskins were not found on the rental agreement or the utility bills. Other people's fingerprints were found on those bills.
So I'm not aware, Mr. Hornell, you've emphasized the desire to have the case reassigned to a different judge, but I'm not aware of any case anywhere in the country in which a certificate of innocence issue was remanded to a different judge. Are you?
I'm not aware of it. Again, there's so little case law in here, I wouldn't expect to find that. So we apply the standards that are typically applied in these cases. And when a district judge has shown resistance to a circuit court's very clear corrective and made statements, a number of statements in his opinion, which are not factual, which are contradicted by the record, and he just makes those statements and he shows no interest in hearing from a defendant. If you had an open mind, if a judge had an open mind, a judge would want to hear from that defendant and let that defendant be tested by cross-examination. The judge would be interested in seeing this new evidence. The fact the judge had no interest in showing that seeing this evidence and writes this opinion, which is, you know, frankly,
well, he looked at the evidence that was put in, but not the evidence that wasn't. So on what authority would we order the district judge to have a hearing rather than simply remand for him to consider the question of how evidence might be amassed?
I'm sorry, I don't understand that question.
In other words, you've asked for us in the alternative to remand for an evidentiary hearing. And I guess my question is, what's the authority on which we could specify the process, hearing versus papers?
I believe that the Seventh Circuit in Abu Swamish versus United States did just that. The circuit courts have an inherent right of supervision over district courts. In this particular case, it's very clear that the district court's refusal to hold a hearing and refusal to allow access to evidence, which, you know, we have pointed out, we know this evidence exists. We've attached the redacted copies. We suspect there's significant more that we weren't able to get to the FOIA process, but we don't know. The district court or the circuit court can certainly order the district court to follow procedures that comport with due process.
Let me make sure my colleagues don't have additional questions for you, Mr. Hornell, before we...
No.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments this morning. We'll take this case under submission.